My name is Sally Steenland, and I'm the director of the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative here at the Center for American Progress. With me today is Bishop Gene Robinson, Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of New Hampshire, and a senior fellow here at the Center for American Progress. Bishop Robinson has also been featured in a new documentary film called Love Free or Die that premiered at Sundance and has been playing around the country, and he's author of an upcoming book called God Believes in Love, Straight Talk About Gay Marriage, which is published by Knopf and coming out this September. On top of all of that, Bishop Gene was just a participant at a panel event we did this morning on religious liberty, what it is and what it isn't. So, Bishop Gene, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And let's just start off, since the panel and the event is so fresh in our minds, and it was a great, really, conversation and discussion about religious liberty that's in the news around contraception and marriage equality issues, but then also talking about religious liberty untethered from some of the headlines attached to other issues. And just sort of as a concept, is there a takeaway that you got from the event that you'd like to share, something that was either surprising to you or that reinforced something you knew or that was new?
I think the most interesting thing for me is that, at least among the panel members, there seemed to be a consensus among us that actually religious liberty is not at risk in this country, and therefore one is left to conclude that it's being used as a wedge issue, as a solution or a problem with something that actually isn't a problem, and one has to wonder what's behind it and what is beneath it. And, you know, one of the things that I was struck by, and I didn't bring it up because I'm not absolutely sure of it, but the research that was presented, the polling, often broke out some of the responses in various ways, and white faithful people seemed to be in a more conservative place than all the rest. Now, you know, you could say that that's mostly evangelicals, but there are an awful lot of evangelicals of color. And, you know, I couldn't help but wonder how it relates to the fact that we have an African-American president. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there have been some of us who have been speculating for a long time that much of the opposition to the policies of the current administration may be code for racism. And you can't get people to admit to their racism in any kind of a poll. But I was struck this morning with the research about what a conservative place white voters are in. And I don't know what that means or where it's going, but I have to say it did come to my mind.
Yeah, white religious voters, white evangelicals, not mm-hmm. all religions, but white evangelicals especially, and then some white older Catholics as well.
Yeah.
You raise an interesting point. It makes you wonder if George Bush were president, if this issue would have the same kind of salience to people, if it
right.
would viscerally get that, like, oh, George Bush is taking away my religious liberty. He's a secular extremist who's trying to, tell people of good faith what to do.
Well, it could be the reason that we see Republicans voting against legislation proposed by the administration that a very few years ago they were proposing themselves. And the only thing that's really changed, as far as I can see, is that we have an African-American president.
Right.
I get that in a partisan sort of way, yeah, you always want to be against the current administration. But really, opposing things that even in the previous administration you were for, right. it just doesn't make sense right. unless you figure in that racism piece.
Right. The The Health Care Act came from the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative
right.
think tank, and was the Republican alternative, the free market alternative to the Clinton health care plan. And it's funny that, you know, as you say, that the individual mandate, which, you know, supposedly destroys our liberty, it was presented as a very conservative concept. And even Mitt Romney, during one of the debates, slipped, and he defended the mandate as we don't want freeloaders. You know, everybody,
right.
it's individual responsibility. Everybody has to pay their fair share. If you don't have insurance, you're going to get sick at some point. You're going to go to the hospital. You're going to go to the emergency room, and the rest of us are going to have to pay for you. No, you don't get a free ride. Everybody's got to put in. And that's individual responsibility is a very friendly concept that to conservatives. They don't own it.
Right.
But it's, you know, not anathema.
Yeah. It's actually at its core a very conservative idea. And one has to wonder why they're so running in the opposite direction from
right.
it.
Right. No, I think that's a very good point. And I think your caution is a good one. And it's a good thing for us all to be on alert when we hear extremist language, sky is falling language about religious liberty, and check it out against the facts, see who the messenger is, see what the issues are behind it before we, you know, start pulling out our own hair, too.
Yeah, I think it's code for something else. And at the end of the day, I think it's a red herring. I even mentioned in the panel that it's not unlike the efforts to purge the voter registration rolls to solve the problem of voter fraud for which there is no evidence.
Right. No, I think that's absolutely right. And the truth is, as you say, religious liberty is alive and well. It's a core American value. It's one that we all treasure.
And a core progressive value.
A core progressive value.
It's not owned by the religious right.
That's exactly right. And there are places in this world where religious liberty is in real trouble. And
one of them isn't America.
Right. Here's the multiple choice. Which one of these
right.
is not America? That's correct. So I want to move on and ask you about Love, Free, or Die, which is the documentary that Mackie Alston, the just really brilliant and very moving documentary film that Mackie Alston did about your life that premiered at Sundance earlier this year. And it's been playing around the country. I know that recently you went to Maine for some screenings and discussions. And so I want to I want you to tell us about the film, what the response has been to it around the country. And I also have a question for you, which is, what was it like to be followed around like that? I mean, I'm really
yeah.
curious about that.
Well, I would not have said yes to this had I not so implicitly trusted Mackie Alston, who his day job is running Auburn Media, which is associated with the Auburn Theological Seminary in New York. And he trains national religious voices to deal effectively with the media. So I did know him and trust him. But even so, the request to follow me around with a film crew for 3 years was daunting to me and my husband Mark. And at the end of the day, we said yes. And what I learned was that, you know, the usual thought that after a little while you don't notice the camera
right.
at all. Yeah, it's not true.
Is that true?
It's not true.
So when the camera's in your kitchen and you and Mark are talking in the kitchen, you know the camera's
exactly.
there.
Like, move out of the way. I need to get into the refrigerator.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
The response to the film has just been overwhelming. I mean, in general, we prepare for, you know, 50 people and 100 show up. You prepare for 100 and 200 show up. We've decided not to do a commercial release of this mm-hmm. film, but rather through word of mouth to get screenings done in people's living rooms and in community centers and in college campuses and church basements. And it is astounding the number of people who decide, yes, indeed, they want to do that. And so they can go to the website, lovefreeordiemovie.com. And there you can say, I want to do a screening in my living room or church basement. And you receive a copy of the film for free and some materials in how to use it. This was especially important in Maine, where they're facing a referendum this fall on marriage equality. It could become the first state that ratifies marriage equality at the ballot box. And with no lawsuit being filed and outside of the legislative process. So it's very exciting. The polling shows that, like all over America, Mainers are increasingly supportive of marriage equality. And I think it stands a really good chance of passage. And we have especially been pushing for screenings in those states that have some sort of marriage equality related initiative on the ballot. That would be Maryland and Maine and Minnesota and Washington State. Those are very, very important places, and we think the movie's going to have a real impact there.
I can see how it would. You know, there are certainly policy issues involved and legal issues that are really important and core. The movie is, number one, it's suspenseful. You know, you sit at the edge of your chair. Who would say there's an Episcopal General Convention? You're going to sit at the end of the chair to see what the vote is. But you do. When we had the screening in D.C. at a packed commercial theater, people, progressives who were not particularly religious, were moved, were in tears at the end, and were actually crying. And it's like, how's the vote going to come out? And because they don't follow Episcopalian politics, they didn't know, you know, how the vote actually did come out. So that's one thing, the suspense. And the other is just the moving stories of people. There are people who do bad things, but nobody's two-dimensionally a demon villain.
Yeah, I think Mackie took great care to not demonize anyone in the movie, although clearly the movie has a viewpoint.
Right.
But people are I believe, portrayed at their very best and in their own words, not described by some third party. You know, going back to the General Convention, you know, Mackie always laughs and says, you know, a church convention being interesting is a stretch, but being the subject of a film is even a bigger stretch. I had a really interesting experience here in Washington. I went to screen the movie with an organization called SMILE, the Sexual Minority Youth Assistance League. It's one of the oldest institutions in America dealing with LGBT teens. There were maybe 15 or 16 kids at this movie, all but one of which was African American, and probably four of whom were transgender. And I thought they would be interested in the movie because it's a very engaging movie. They were absolutely glued to the screen with this general convention.
Right, exactly.
And it's the only audience that I've been present to see the movie with where when the vote was taken and it was in favor of the blessing of same-sex unions and the ordination of gay and lesbian people to all orders of ministry in the church, they actually cheered.
Oh.
And you know, what I think about that is that we have so lost our respect for institutions.
Yeah.
And everyone is feeling anti-institutional these days. And it said to me that these teenagers want to believe in institutions again. I mean, we actually need institutions, you know? And so when they saw one actually doing good, they cheered.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really telling. And it was very moving for me because as much as I fight with the church, I also believe in it, you know. And so to see their sort of renewed appreciation for this old, lethargic, slow to change institution that actually has changed quite a lot in the last few years.
Yeah, and also it's like reality TV. I mean, it's not Law and Order. The vote really makes a decision and it makes a difference in the real world in people's
Absolutely.
Lives.
You know, there's a young Episcopalian. I think she's Asian American who stands up and says, you know, this is I'm a gay Episcopalian. This is not an issue for me. This is my life.
Yeah.
And I think that's exactly right.
That's it.
And so it was really nice to see that portrayed well in the movie and get the word out that there actually are some progressive religious groups doing some very good work.
The stakes are high. And it also shows, to your point of how sort of cynical or jaded people get, the people weren't scripted. And so when people were speaking from their heart and saying, I used to be this way, I'm now, you know, this is what I'm struggling with, those very honest, raw struggles, that drama that deep anguish and change and struggle, you cannot not identify with. It just really touches your heart on a very deep level. And it's a form of art, really.
Yeah, you know, and there's a particular woman that I think is very powerful in the movie, and many people point to her. She's crying. And she says, I can't vote for this.
Right.
But I can neither celebrate nor apologize. I just have to be who I am the way you say you need to be who you are. And she says, I just want you to know that all the pain around this issue has not been on your side. Mm. There are those of us who are opposed to this change in our church, and it's very painful to us as well. And I think that's just a telling moment that this is a painful thing. And frankly, you know, I'm sympathetic in the sense that we're asking people to change their mind about something that we taught them about for generations, right?
So
we should not be surprised that this is difficult for people because, after all, we're the ones who taught them the other way, right? And now we're saying we're changing the rules. And that's an upsetting
hard.
Experience.
Right. It's like, never mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not theoretical. It touches – marriage touches to a core issue.
And, of course, it strikes fear in the hearts of people because if you change this, then what's going to be the next thing and the next thing and the next thing? And then will they even recognize their religion anymore?
Well, you've talked about that before, and that's a really interesting thing, that the slippery slope is what makes people nervous, because we do need some absolutes in our life. We do need some certainties that are of what's right and wrong. And if an Orthodox faith, if certain Christian beliefs are very important to you, your fear may be like, oh no, next thing you know, I'm going to say Jesus was just another dude, you know?
And it's the camel's nose under the tent. I think that is a well-founded fear. So when I'm speaking to groups, particularly more conservative groups, I take great care in letting them know that actually I'm theologically very conservative. But the fact of the matter is we're not arguing over the Trinity or the divine and human nature of Jesus or the resurrection. We're talking about a particular social interpretation of a few passages of Scripture. And so, you know, the Anglican Church around the world and the Episcopal Church here in this country has this very important distinction between the essentials and the non-essentials. And so I would say the things, for instance, in the historic creeds of the first few centuries, the Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed, contain the essentials. And then as long as we agree about those, we can disagree about the non-essentials. And frankly, you take any one of our congregations and name an issue from abortion to stem cell research to who should be president, and you've got people in that congregation all over the map on those non-essentials.
Sure.
But we find our way to the altar rail and receive the body and blood of Christ in communion. We find our unity there, and then go back to the pews and fight about all those other things. And I think that is exactly right.
Sure, sure. So you've been in this movie that you're now traveling with for screenings, and you've also written a book. And the book is coming out this fall, and it's called God Believes in Love: Straight Talk About Gay Marriage. So why did you write the book, and give us a peek as to what's in it?
The idea of the book came from someone else, actually. The book agent for Archbishop Desmond Tutu contacted me and said he had heard me on NPR talking about gay marriage and thought there was a book there. And so as we developed the idea for this book, I imagined a conversation between me and someone that I would call in the movable middle. Someone who doesn't hate us anymore would certainly describe themselves as tolerant of gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. but is not prepared to go all the way to supporting marriage. And so I took, in that imagined conversation, I took each one of the objections mm-hmm. to marriage, equality, marriage equality, and each one of those became a chapter in the book, so that as we move through the course of the book, hopefully I will have answered the reservations people have about each of those things, and so that at the end of the book, they're back to the place of the title, which is, you know, at the end of the day, God believes in love. And we have that passage from the first letter of John, which says, where love is, there God is. And I make the case that the fact of the matter is, as more and more couples get more and more known to their families, to their coworkers, to their former classmates, we see love there.
Yeah.
And that is unmistakable. And if love is there, then God is for it.
Sure. You know, one thing I've always thought is, you know, the visceral response many religious people have to who are opponents of same-sex marriage, and it's based on the Bible or religion or whatever, but it's so strongly felt. And okay, so there are these Bible passages that one wants to deal with. But if you look at Bible passages about money and about having to give away your, you know, money, a rich man and a camel going through the eye of a needle and all the things Jesus, sell all you have, give to the poor, that's really clear. And yet people's hair don't get on fire about the fact of, oh, yeah, I still have money. Oh, yeah, I haven't sold everything. It's not that same visceral reaction. People may feel guilty that they should tithe more or something like that, but it's not the same. So given the difference in the intensity of emotion, I think should be a clue that there's something else going on besides the Bible.
Sure. I think that's absolutely true. And anyone who tells you that they just simply read Scripture without any interpretation – really, walk away,
really?
Because you're not going to get very far with them.
Stop now.
You know, I never once heard Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell quote Luke where Jesus says, if you want to be a follower of mine, you must give up all your possessions.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
So, yeah, I think there is something else going on. And part of it is, I think that for a very long time, we had sexuality figured out. And now it doesn't seem all that neat and tidy. And I think we're going to see even more anxiety as the transgender issue comes more to the foreground. Because I think it says that sexuality is very much more fluid than we once thought. And in some ways, I think the neat and tidy Kinsey scale between gay and straight has led us astray into thinking in this kind of bifurcated way, when in fact I think what we will ultimately discover, that each one of us has a unique sexuality.
Yeah.
Because when you think of it, take any group of straight people, gay people, whatever, each one of them is so terribly different. The very thing that turns one person on sexually is a total turn off for another person.
Right.
Yet they're both straight or they're both gay.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is, no two of us have the same history. And so each one of us is a unique collection of experiences that make us who we are. And yet when it seems that open, I think it makes people anxious.
Well, and I think you're right. And I think what also makes people anxious is a more open acceptance of gender. So what does it mean to be male? What does it mean to be female? And for a while, since the feminist movement, girls have had more freedom to play with trucks, to wear overalls, to be assertive, to play sports and all of that. And that hasn't really shifted back. So if your little boy wants to, you know, paint his toes, or if he wants to play with the Barbies, or if he wants to dress up in the princess dress, there's anxiety. There tends to be more anxiety along those lines than the little girl who wants to play with the truck.
Well, and I think the reason for that is, and this may be the other reason why people are anxious about these discussions we're having, And by the way, I would maintain that men are more anxious about these discussions than women.
I would agree with that.
And the reason, I think, is that ultimately this is about the end of patriarchy.
This is one
of the building blocks of patriarchy. And in fact, if you dismantle this one, then, you know, ultimately what it leads to is this kind of radical egalitarianism that the world hasn't seen in memory. And so I think particularly for men, the changes haven't been as freeing as they have for women or girls and boys, because if you paint your toes and play with Barbies, and that leads to your allowing yourself to be treated like a woman, you give up your male privilege and join the ranks of lesser human beings, namely women.
You're a girl.
Then you have defied the gods.
Yeah.
Certainly the patriarchal gods.
Yeah.
And so I think you put all that together, and then you've got that visceral response.
I think you're right, and I think where we're seeing some movement or progress is sort of economically, as you look at younger families, and we've seen this in some work that we've done, where. As families are making economic decisions, women are working more and more these days, and the two partners sit around the kitchen table, and they say, "Okay, you know, here's our monthly budget. Here's the money we have. We've got three kids. How are we divvying up the expenses?" And it is more of a partnership, I think, than it used to be. And I think a lot of men are like, no, no, I need my wife to work to have all of that responsibility on my shoulder, where I'm the breadwinner for everybody, would make me crazy. So the idea of having somebody you can talk to, somebody who shares decisions with you, I think in the real world, that's starting to happen more. That's just the way people are living. And if you grow up, you know, with boys and girls as buddies, it's I think it's a little freer.
Sure. And remember, it really wasn't all that long ago when the paradigm was different.
Yeah.
The man was the breadwinner, and the wife stayed at home and took care of the kids. And, there is tremendous pressure on the family and upon marriages and so on today. Not put there by the issue of gay marriage, but the pressure is put there by these economic factors that I think are really huge and rather unprecedented.
So let's talk about those economic factors. I'm glad you brought that up. If you watch the news or read the newspaper, the economic news is not good at all. In fact, there was a story this week about how the accumulated wealth of American families has dropped to 1995 levels. So people have lost about 20 years worth of wealth. We're way back, almost 20 years ago. People who have jobs are worried about losing them, worried about one couple of paychecks away from being foreclosed on your home. Your job may or may not have health care. You may have sick kids. And those are for people who are even sort of struggling to keep their heads above water. There are a lot of people who can't find jobs, who've been unemployed for a long time. And Jeb Bush this week said, we're a nation in decline. I mean, we're just in decline. And that decline narrative of our best days are behind us. Our kids are going to have it much worse than we did. Millennials saying we're going to have to work till we're 80. We're broke. As a person of faith, also an American, a concerned American, what do you have to say to that kind of bleakness?
Well, I think that I would not say that America is in decline. I'm essentially a hopeful and optimistic person. But I don't think there is necessarily evidence to show that we won't come out of this, but I think it's important to talk about what is the reality of what some people are calling a decline. The fact of the matter is if you look at the salaries of middle class people over the last let's say 20 years, it's essentially flatlined.
Right.
If you look at the income of the wealthiest 1%, it is a climbing number of staggering proportions.
It's like Mount Everest. It goes straight up.
It goes almost straight up. And so I think and what's interesting is that some of the people who have profited the most in the last 20 years are the ones who are saying we're in decline for political purposes, which is just bizarre. I think it's important to, not take an axe to this problem when a very finely, sculpted knife is what's needed to dissect it, and to say that it is the middle class in particular that that are being preyed upon mm-hmm. by the few, and then as an effort to solve that problem, the middle class, who know they're not doing very well, are recruited into taking out the difference on the most vulnerable yeah. and the poorest. Yeah. So it's a terrible combination, and somehow I think the Republican Party seems to be just incredibly good at getting people to vote against their own self-interest. And I've read a really interesting book that I want to take a lot of time with in retirement. It's called The Righteous Mind.
Oh yeah, and Jonathan Haidt.
Yeah,
yes.
And
yes.
And I think it's one of the most important books that's come out lately. And it talks about how Democrats only appeal to two of the five or six sort of foundational values, moral compasses that we have available to us, and Republicans respond to all of them, and consequently, because of those various values, can talk many Americans into voting against their own best interest yeah. Because of these other kinds of foundations. And I think progressive people need to pay attention to that, both in terms of changing people's minds, but also us not writing off those who are conservative, but actually seeking to understand what they feel are important and sacred values. And I think unless we do that, we're not going to be able to respond politically and legislatively to the ills that face us. So I would say, no, we're not in decline. Are we going through a tough time? Absolutely. And are we very tempted at this point to take this out on those least able to bear any more? Yes, I think mm-hmm. we are, and I think we have to stand up to that. And going back to our earlier conversation, there's probably no theme in Scripture, both the Jewish scriptures of the Old Testament, the Christian scriptures of the New, no theme more clearly articulated than that God will judge us on how we care for the most vulnerable in our midst. I just wish we could hear the biblical literalists talking about
you
that.
You can't get away from that.
No.
You really can't. I just want to close with a personal question for you. So next year you're going to retire from being bishop.
I'm looking for a different word.
Okay, so you're going to...
someone told me I should be talking about my encore.
Your encore career.
Yes.
Your encore career. You're going to segue into a new adventure of your life.
Right.
So what are you going to miss about not being New Hampshire's Episcopal bishop anymore? And then what's on the horizon for you?
I go through the day now, this being my last year, I retire at the end of 2012, and I'll be doing something and I'll think, oh, gosh, I am really going to miss this.
Oh, yeah.
I love my visitations out in congregations. I love talking with young people who I think we undersell the younger generation as being sort of not – interested in religion. They are interested in religion, and more especially in a relationship with God. And I think churches that are failing are those that have forgotten that their central purpose is to facilitate people's relationship with mm-hmm. a living God. And where that's happening, kids are totally turned on. And they are more interested in how faith is being put into practice, and so They're out working in soup kitchens. They're out doing systemic work politically. So, you know, I love that. I love being in touch with them. And I have to say that in New Hampshire, which is actually more libertarian than it is conservative, fighting against this rugged individualism, which both has been America's strength and I believe is its greatest vulnerability, because at the end of the day, we're a community, and that individualism argues for an every man, woman, and child for themselves kind of approach. And it seems to me that the religious message of virtually every religious institution is that, no, actually, we're a family. We're a community. And I've loved working for that, and which leads me to you know, what I'll be doing afterwards. I really believe that's the message that the religious faith community can offer in the civil discourse that has become anything but civil. And so I'm looking to expand my time here at the Center for American Progress.
Yay.
And I'm really excited that you know, this is a progressive organization that actually believes that moral discourse is relevant to these enormous discussions and problematic discussions we're having in this country. And I would say, both in terms of their process and how we treat one another while we're fighting about these things. Nothing wrong with fighting about over these issues, but how we treat one another in the midst of fighting about them is a profoundly moral question.
It is.
And I think we've lost our moral way. And so both speaking to that process and then to the issues themselves is something that is very exciting to me. And I can't think of a better bunch of buddies to have than those here at CAP. I always feel like I have to row really hard to keep up here,
no.
So great.
You're our guiding star. You really, really are. Yeah.
And I'm also I've gotten increasingly involved in a congregation here in D.C. St. Thomas DuPont Circle.
Yes.
It's a historic parish. It was actually where Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt worshipped.
Oh, I didn't know that.
When they were here in Washington, and I just learned this boggles my mind. So the senior warden is like the head layperson.
Now, that's
right?
The church that burned, right?
Well, I was just going to
say.
I learned that while he was president, FDR served as the senior warden of St. Thomas's. Can you imagine president having any spare time?
Can you imagine that?
Shows how much the presidency has changed.
And can you imagine the press covering that now?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Separation of church and state.
My God. And the political issues of the church, whatever he's dealing with, would be on the front page. Wow.
Well, this congregation, as I say, is historic. 40 years ago, it was torched by an arsonist burned to the ground.
Oh, I didn't know it was
probably
arson.
Because of their stance against the Vietnam War.
Is that right?
Yeah. And they made this really remarkable decision not to build back. And so they took the land on which the church, it was a fabulous Gothic church, took that land and made a public park out of it. And the very back part of the park are the burned out remains of the back of the altar. So it's a beautiful and moving place. But after 40 years, they've decided now to build. So they asked if I would be the honorary chair of their capital campaign, which I was happy to do. And then last September, they came to me and with the idea that they wanted to name the small chapel in the church, the new church, for me. Which is just
It
was very moving, and I still can't quite get my mind around it. I said to them, don't you have to be either dead or very, very good in order to have something like that happen?
I'm a healthy man.
So, yeah, exactly. But so I'm very excited about that, and this new church that we hope to build is a very multi-use kind of plan, and the idea is to sort of make it a community center for the nation's capital.
Wow.
And so maybe we'll even have some CAP events there from time to time.
We would love that.
Yeah. And one of the things that we're hoping to do is to become a place where people can come and learn about nonviolent conversation so that we can change the nature of the debate here in Washington.
Oh, that just sounds very exciting.
I think that should keep me busy, don't you think?
I think that'll keep you busy.
Not necessarily out of trouble, but busy.
Right. Staying in trouble is you're always in good trouble.
Good trouble.
There's good trouble. Well, thank you so much for being with us. It was a pleasure.
You're very welcome. I'm delighted to be here.
Take care.